Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 303 of Her, the podcast where you're going to hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and her heartwarming. In other words, how her inner thermostat makes her human. Whoa, that's compelling. All right, now hold on now. We've got a terrific show. Just know that before we begin, this episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And here's your reminder to click on iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show because we love your feedback. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
Okay. Now, let's talk about something that is just kind of mind-blowing. And that is our inner thermostat. Now, what in the heck am I talking about? I'm talking about thermal wellness. I'm talking about thermoregulation, how our sense of temperature is tied in with emotion. Yeah, I see you out there. You're just saying, say what? Is this new science? Is this something exciting? Well, here's the really great news. The great news is that we have a book and the scientists behind the book to talk about this brand new maverick way of looking at our lives and how temperature really is a central focus in how we perceive our reality. It's amazing. So the name of the book, of course, is Heartwarming: How Our Inner Thermostat Made Us Human. The expert is Dr. Hans Ischermann. Now, Hans is an associate professor at the Université Grenoble Alpes, and he has a PhD in something fascinating, social psychology, and he's going to tell us more about what that really means. What he's been able to do is go into a place many other scientists have not really looked at closely, and that is the relationship between emotion and our inner thermostat, which I find to be absolutely amazing. Without further ado, Hans, welcome to the Her Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Why'd you write this book?
For a long time, I really wanted to kind of put together my thoughts on temperature regulation and its importance in interpersonal relationships. Because oftentimes, as a social psychologist, I'm doing experiments that aim to show the relationship between one variable and another. But there was so much more work out there that I think is relevant for how humans form interpersonal relationships, whether that is on other animals, animals other than humans, or whether it's about languages, so domains that psychologists typically don't look at. And this book really gave me the opportunity to kind of try to synergize all that work.
Okay, amazing. And you know what I was surprised about when I read the book, and I might say delightfully surprised, is that it's got so many stories in it. You know, at first I thought, I'm going to get hammered with a lot of science here. And the great news for everyone out there who's obviously going to go and buy the book is that it's beautiful. The prose is beautiful. The stories are compelling. And it's really relatable. For instance, chapter one, hot beverages, electric blankets, and loneliness. Wow. You know, when I was reading this, I didn't realize the historical importance of things like central heating and how that's changed our lives. Now, a lot of people may say, what do you mean central heating is that big a deal? But it is, because what was it? You said that as early as, it was the mid-19th century, people were still kind of bundling all up together in one big bed. How did things change, Hans?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. In the 18th century in Paris, for example, and even as late as the 19th century in Ireland, people would sleep with about six or seven people in one bed. Because, of course, without central heating, Your core body temperature will lower to an extent that it's unhealthy, or it may even become threatening. But in the 20th century, and of course now, we have central heaters so that it's much less necessary to sleep with others in one bed. So this is not necessarily indeed what you said. It's more a story that I tell about, how did this develop rather than the actual science. So we didn't really investigate, and I cannot really say when did it change, but at least we know that with the coming of the central heater, it became much, much less relevant to sleep with more than one person in a bed.
Well, you know, because of this book, I'm now so aware of my own verbiage. Oh, he's such a warm person. Oh, she's so cold. You know, where did that come from?
Yeah, so there are a couple different types of theories that are related to these kind of metaphors. If people are familiar with linguistics, there is a very popular theory called conceptual metaphor theory that kind of suggests that we need these concrete experiences like warmth to understand more abstract concepts like affection. That is one theory about this. I think the hypothesis that I work from with my colleagues is more that this is kind of epiphenomenal, that these expressions are more descriptions of our experiences, because a lot of what we experience in relation to temperature regulation in our relationships is basically biological. It's not this kind of abstract thinking about what affection is, but it's more it's kind of more a description of what is going on. Now, mind you, speakers of English or my own language, Dutch, we have these kind of metaphors in our language. But this is not true for all languages around the world. So in most Indo-European languages, which English and Dutch are, we use these kind of metaphors to describe somebody maybe as a warm or a cold person. But many non-Indo-European languages, and particularly the ones close to the equator, don't use those metaphors mixing warmth and affection. So Ghanaian language, Gur, if you say that somebody has a cold heart, for example, it is somebody that is a very cool and tranquil person. And there they don't use the metaphor to express that somebody is a very warm and affectionate person.
Huh, interesting. So one of the central, core foci in your book, basically, not just temperature regulation per se, but social thermoregulation. Can you define that? What is social thermoregulation?
The question of a definition is a difficult one, but I'll try my best.
Go for it.
I think, what is probably easy to understand is the temperature regulation is something important for each and every one of us. So if we don't regulate our body temperature, we die. After oxygen, it's something that we need to do all the time. Now, something where temperature regulation is very different from oxygen regulation is that temperature in the environment fluctuates all the time, and that's not the case for oxygen regulation. This means that we have kind of all kinds of systems in our body to try to both detect and regulate temperature as well as possible. But that makes temperature regulation also very, very expensive metabolically. So if you look at animals other than humans, if temperatures drop, their base metabolic rate goes up by quite a lot. So they need to exert a lot more energy, and we as humans do too. If we have other animals, we humans, but also other animals, animals other than humans, if we have others to rely on, we can huddle with them and we can kind of share the costs of temperature regulation. That makes particularly dealing with colder environments a lot cheaper metabolically. So if we can rely on other people, then it also should make the kind of the energetic load of the environment much, much lower. Now, I've talked more about colder temperatures. That is also because warmer temperatures, when we're confronted with them, We cannot necessarily rely on others because warmer temperatures usually are immediately threatening. So our body and the body of other animals need to cope with that right away. Because if you don't, you can die or there is severe brain malfunction. So typically colder temperatures, we can rely on others. Warmer temperatures, we can't. So there's kind of an asymmetry there. And that means that for colder temperatures, we can socially thermoregulate our core body temperature.
So what happens then with social isolation?
That's a very complicated question. So in the psychological literature more broadly, social isolation, what my colleague Julianne Holdlundstedt has found is that if we are socially isolated from others, this is typically threatening for our health. So she has found that if you compare, for example, social isolation to other known risk factors exercising or not frequently, drinking six glasses of alcohol per day or not, that social isolation is a bigger risk factor for our health and for dying sooner than these other risk factors. So social isolation itself can be a severe health risk and a severe risk for mortality. Now, we have been trying to work towards this in relation to thermoregulation because we suspect that one of the mechanisms is thermoregulation. Of course, if you're far away from others, there's no way that you can kind of co-regulate temperature with each other. That being said, we have all kinds of modern technologies to take care of thermoregulation as well. We've talked about central heaters. We now have other devices that can also keep us warm or cool us down. So there are probably novel ways that we can deal with this rather than just people alone. But there are also remnants of this that where we're trying to discover the mechanisms why, for example, social isolation may lead to an earlier death. And we're not quite there yet in just understanding this puzzle.
You know, this whole issue of loneliness per se, social isolation obviously has come front and center, especially with the era of COVID, lockdowns, the inability to be able to be with other people. So to your point, this whole issue has never been so important. And you mentioned technology, and you and I both know because we're interrelating on some projects here with technology. Ember Labs has developed a wearable on the wrist called the Wave, and it is just come out with a new piece of its application called the Embrace, which interestingly sends a warm hug, sort of a sense of warmth through the device itself, because the device is one that changes the perception of heating and cooling. And that's one of the reasons why I thought, wow, this issue of social isolation, we now have some technological, you know, solutions, hopefully that will at least begin to help people and obviously provide some high-tech touch for those who are in trouble. I'm also thinking about other things too, and that is this whole issue of utilizing temperature as treatment. You know, from depression to cancer is one of your chapters, which I found to be very compelling. Can you tell us how that actually works?
Yeah, there are several studies now on temperature regulation and depression itself. Some of these studies, what they try to do, they try to heat up the entire body to try to reduce depression symptoms. Now, that being said, there are some criticisms, particularly by my colleague Eiko Fried, whether there is a strong support for warmth treatment for depression. And I think those criticisms are still convincing. So, for example, the sample size are relatively small in those kind of studies. And from a theoretical perspective, you were talking about this new technology. Now, let's think about if you want to implement this new technology, the Ember Wave, in one's daily life. I think it's if you want to try to implement this as a kind of a touch device communication at a distance, intuitively, I think it's easy to understand that we don't want to necessarily use a technology with any type of person. We want to use it with specific people at very specific moments. So we don't want to use the Ember Way, for example, when we go for a job interview or when we go when we talk online with a stranger that we don't necessarily want a romantic contact with. And I think the same is true also for thinking about temperature regulation and depression. So you referred earlier to social isolation, for example. When we think about social isolation, it's known or thought to be correlated with being more depressed. And I suspect that, for example, these kind of touch interventions or warmth interventions can reduce feelings of depression, but if they are responsive to the individual person. So it's not necessarily that warmth will lead to a decrease of depression, but it will have to be designed such that it's appropriate for an increase in social contact, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. How does that work with cancer?
For cancer, I think the relationship is a little bit more complicated. So I have to say right off the bat that I am not a cancer expert. But one of the tissues that is important for thermoregulation is a fat called brown adipose tissue. So brown adipose tissue kind of is an insulating material for the body. Until about 2007, they thought that adult human beings did not have brown adipose tissues, but they discovered then that we do have it. It is so brown adipose tissue itself, the presence of it is also related to the development of tumors. And in activating, for example, brown adipose tissue to generate body heat, weight loss from specific types of cancer, it might stimulate an energetic, wasteful, and maladaptive response to anorexia. So a lot of these studies are still in mice, and they're not in human beings yet. And the reason for this is because brown adipose tissue is actually very difficult to study. So typically you can only study it with CT scans, so with radioactive tracers. And in normal populations, oftentimes you would not use these radioactive tracers. So there's still very little research on brown adipose tissue, but there's some promising studies that show the relationship between brown adipose tissue and tumor development itself.
Ah, okay. Very good. You know, this is complicated. There's absolutely no question about it. When I ask you these questions, you know, I'm secretly saying to myself, oh my gosh, you know, I hope we can wade through so many of the complexities when we talk about thermoregulation and medical conditions, say, for instance. But I think that this is extremely helpful. You know, kind of pivoting here for a second, you had a really fun chapter here that I had a lot of gleeful joy reading, and that is why you should sell your house on a colder day. Tell us why.
Yeah, so I had students back when I was in the Netherlands who were interested in running the study. So this was a study led by some of my students. And they were interested in whether temperature differences could also lead to people seeing a house differently. There's kind of maybe an interesting backstory to this, because some of the first studies that we ran on this, we were actually dead wrong on what we thought we would find. And because initially in the literature, the idea was that if you kind of prime something, so priming is kind of the idea that you make thoughts accessible, then you would find when you would prime warmth, you would find that people would think that a house is more home-like, and as a result, that people would be more interested in buying it. So that's kind of the hypothesis that we had a priori. But when we started running the study, we ran kind of like an initial tryout study where we would give participants a warm or cold cup to hold. So that's a way that we manipulated temperature in these studies. And when we manipulated temperature in the first study, what we would find is that actually when people would hold a cold cup, they would find a house more home-like And as a consequence, they would also be willing to pay more for it. Now, why would that be the case? One thing that we started reasoning is that, well, when people are in a cold condition, they actually see a house more kind of as a dwelling, as a safe place. We've talked a little bit about social thermoregulation and the need to protect body temperature. Well, there is also literature in the psychological literature that kind of defines that we have attachment to houses, just as we have attachment to people. And what we started reasoning is that, well, when people are in colder conditions, they probably have a greater drive to be with others, to contact others, to email others, to call others. So we wanted to measure what is called the need for affiliation. So we did that in a second study. And instead of using a manipulated temperature, we actually used outside temperature. So we observed outside temperature. And then we wanted to see, well, do people, when the temperatures drop, do they have a greater need to affiliate with others? Do they want to be more with others? And does that in turn drive kind of their desire for specific houses? So we selected a number of different houses from Dutch housing sites and that people wouldn't know because it was in another town. And we measured the need for affiliation. That went up indeed when people were on colder days. And as a result, what we found is that people then would also judge houses to be more attractive and to be more kind of communal, to be more trustworthy, because we also assign kind of personality characteristics to products or even houses. And what we find then as a consequence is that under colder conditions, that people were more willing to pay for houses.
Oh my God. Okay. Well, you know, I was laughing to myself with the last house I sold. I'm always doing something baking bread or cookies or something in the oven so that the whole house smells good. But also there's a sense of warmth in there. And so I think that that obviously helps too. But now I realize there's a whole thermoregulatory background science behind it. So I'm all happy. I'm going to definitely keep that in mind with the next house sale. Oh my gosh.
And maybe if I may interject there as well.
Yeah.
Of course, this is only part of the variance, because a large part of the variance is also just seasonal effects. You just said that you have sold houses before, so you will also know that in different parts of the year, just because of economic developments or when people are going to their next paycheck, those are big reasons for people to pay more for a house. So this is only a small part of the variance. That's also important to realize.
Oh, no. You keep that in mind. You know, this is one of the reasons why I assume they have the same thing in Europe. And that is always make sure to sell the house, ideally in a time of year when you have beautiful flowers out and, you know, it's not in the dead of winter and all the rest of it. So, you know, there is definitely a seasonal bias there, too. Speaking of bias. I'm incredibly biased toward those happy Costa Ricans. One of my fondest memories is being in Costa Rica and having the absolute honor of going to Nicoya, which was one of the blue zones where the 100-year-olds live, and just experiencing, as you said in the book, the temperature, the weather, and the well-being. All right, go for it. Why did you talk about the Costa Ricans when it came to this whole issue of social thermoregulation?
One of the things that people typically ask me when talking about temperature is just that warmth is positive, and warmth drives positive affect. Warmth drives happiness. Maybe it's also the case that I am from the Netherlands and that it's kind of a gloomy country, that so that when we manipulate temperature, that people always think that that is necessarily driving people's positive moods. But it's a little bit more complicated than that. Warmth doesn't necessarily drive people to feel positive. I think you read probably in the book as well. I was writing one of the chapters at kind of the end of the summer in Grenoble, which is one of the warmest cities in France. And I was just delighted that it was getting colder. So that's one of the reasons why I kind of wanted to write about this, that it's not as straightforward. And one of the things that people frequently discuss as well is seasonal affective disorder. There's a very nice study also from the Netherlands where they weren't able to find a direct link between season and seasonal affective disorder, so that people were feeling more depressed, for example, in the winter in the Netherlands. So there was no clear relationship between that. Now, there was a recent study in 2017 kind of that points out maybe some more of this complexity, where they actually look at, instead of more direct effects on mood, they look at more longer term effects on personality. What they looked at, this was a team of Chinese researchers. What they looked at is they looked at 59 different Chinese cities and a data set from a little bit over 12,000 US zip codes. And what they wanted to look at, they wanted to see if there's a difference in terms of temperature and personality. And they do find a pretty reliable effect there. So what they find is that when people live in more clement cultures, which I guess Costa Rica is getting very close to, that the people there, they tend to be kind of higher on certain personality factors that we would describe as agreeable, conscientious, emotionally stable, to be more extroverted, and to be more open to new experiences. So they all score higher on those kind of things, which typically we would think that those people are more sociable, for example. So people in more clement cultures, and clement cultures are about 22 degrees Celsius, which kind of translates to 71.6 degrees Fahrenheit. So people in those cultures tend to score higher on those personality dimensions.
Huh, interesting. So, you know, again, looking at the whole issue of season and personality and thermoregulation, one of my dearest friends is Norm Rosenthal. And while I was at the National Institutes of Health, I had a chance to do a couple of collaborations with him. He was the South African researcher who basically defined seasonal affective disorder. And he noticed the big change when he left South Africa, and you know where that's located in terms of clement weather, to New York. Big mistake when it came to the winters especially, and really had an issue. And, you know, it's interesting. One of my collaborations with him was basically looking at people's weight changes, of their body composition changes as they entered the dark winter months. And I think dark also is another big issue here. So, you know, as you've said a number of times, it's complex. You know, there's a lot of complications here that one has to keep in mind. But when it comes to social thermoregulation, what are the things that you most want to be able to communicate about that to people? Here you have an audience out there who's going to read your book and really wants to understand this. What's one of the easiest ways for people to wrap their head around what social thermoregulation really means, you know, in their life, in reality?
So I think perhaps one of the studies that is easiest to grasp and that I find the most interesting effect that we found so far is what kind of our social network does to our own core body temperature. And that also kind of highlights the difference with other animals. So in vervet monkeys, that is a species that is typically studied for their similarity to humans, what they find is that when these monkeys have a larger social network, their lower core part of their minimum core body temperature is higher when they have a larger social network. So, for example, when the temperatures drop, their temperatures do not get as low if they basically have more friends.
Oh my God.
So there's a relatively straightforward link there because it's just about the number of friends. Now, humans are, of course, a little bit more complicated than that because we have much more complex social lives than other animals. Like you said, you know, we talk to each other from a distance. We talk to each other from a distance right now on this podcast. We have volunteer groups. People have church groups. They have sport teams that they interact with. What we found in one of our studies where we had participants from 12 different countries, so these were more than 1,500 participants, we wanted to figure out, well, what kind of social variable predicts core body temperature in humans? So we kind of twisted the logic, because typically psychologists try to come up with a hypothesis beforehand, and then they try to look for that in the data. They try to disconfirm their hypothesis. We try to turn that around. We basically ask from the data which of the variables predicts core body temperature. So our participants, they measured their own core body temperature twice, and they took pictures of this. They sent us to our platform. And what we did then, we gave them a large number of questions about their social network, about how they felt in relationships, also how their attachment to homes were, because this we found before that this may matter. We also asked about their emotional regulation, for example. So how do they regulate their emotions? Can they recognize their own emotions? And the single one of the variables that is one of the top predictors is the diversity of our social network. So the more diverse our social network is, the higher our core body temperature. Now, this primarily happens in countries that are further away from the equator, so in colder countries. So in colder countries, the diversity of our social network protects our core body temperature. So this is an effect that I think is fascinating. It's relatively straightforward. Only the mechanism is, again, more complicated, I think, what we've also pointed to.
Wow. Wow. I'm just thinking about that. I'm just saying to myself, I got to make more friends. I want to be warm. I just love this. It just adds another dimension to how important it is that we remain connected, that the sort of social connectivity is essential to survival, along with social thermoregulation. You noted toward the end of the book, your words, social thermoregulation is essential to survival, and it is just as essential to thriving. So it's not just about surviving, it's thriving. It is a concept, a phenomenon, and a mechanism that reveals us to ourselves as organisms and as humans. Social thermoregulation is a lens through which we individuals appear as what we truly and finally are. Beings who need each other and who have transformed this need into neighborhoods and nations, societies and civilizations. Okay, Hans, you bowled me over with that one. That was just beautiful. What a lovely way to put it in perspective so that we understand how it fits in with our need to connect with other people. What do you think?
Well, obviously, I agree with those words. One thing that I wanted to return to, because I think I wasn't entirely clear about with the explanation on the previous point, because it's not just about friends, but the diversity of the social network is really about participating in diverse social groups. So it's not for human beings, it's not just about having a greater number of friends, but it is about participating in a greater number of social groups that helps protect our core body temperature. Now, relating this to the last point that we were discussing now, one of the things that we've also found so far is that, so we've also developed a questionnaire where one can measure to what degree people desire social thermoregulation. And what we find there is that it reliably correlates also with self-reported health. So the more people desire social thermoregulation, so the more they want to warm up with others when they're cold, the healthier they are. So that's not a causal relationship, but at least we find a correlation between those two concepts.
Oh, I love this. This is, you know, it's really mind-blowing at the end of the day. I don't think people think like this at all. I think that we just, you know, people don't know what they don't know. And I think one of the great gifts of your book is to open people's eyes to the power of social thermoregulation and to really be more attentive to, more mindful of the need for these diverse social interactions and connections, and that they can support not just survival, but thriving, more optimal health. One last thing, have you found any research that really speaks to longevity and this whole phenomenon of social thermoregulation?
Within the social thermoregulation, the best we have so far is these self-reported relationships with health. One of the reasons is also that longevity is, of course, a more complicated concept to study. The concept of social thermoregulation has only become popular in the literature in the last 12 years. So I think this is one of the things that we need to study in the next few years. The only indirect link that I can make is with these studies that Julianne Holt-Lundstedt and her colleagues have done, where you do find links between social isolation and longevity, where we know that if people are more socially isolated, they their chance of dying sooner is greater.
Absolutely. You know, you make me smile there for a moment when you were talking about, self-reported. There's actually some really interesting data that's coming out of a number of the longevity institutes, one at USC with Walter Longo's group and others. And what they found, interestingly, is they're looking for predictors for higher quality of life as well as quantity. And that's the issue of health span and lifespan. I'd rather have a really robust health span. And one of the interesting ones was this was a study that was done in some retirement communities, large ones in California, in the USA. And they found that those people who regularly attended bingo games, you know, it's a social game where you get together at least once a week and you have a full-on night of a lot of fun with all of your friends, engaging, being close to one another, there's probably a little food involved, that was a stronger predictor of longevity than if you took a walk every day for fitness. Now, I kind of like that. In other words, it's the power of social connectivity. So I hope that put a smile in your face too. Bingo and a walk. Ideally, you're doing both of those.
It certainly did. And I think that's a fascinating effect. And actually, more anecdotally, when people get older, their ability to thermoregulate also goes down. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to study people at older age, but it's one of the things that I still want to study. And I think it's actually an important domain of study, but it's a fascinating effect that you describe.
Absolutely. I love it. All right. Everyone out there, I've had just nothing but the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Hans Isserman. He is the author of the brand new book, Heartwarming, How Our Inner Thermostat Made Us Human. I'm telling you, reading this was just an absolute pleasure because it was written so well. But at the same time, you're being given science. You're gifted with science you didn't even know existed. And now you're going to understand its importance in not only your survival, but also in thriving. Hans, I can't thank you enough for being on the HER podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. And everyone out there right now, run on over to iTunes, rate and review the show because I want to know your thoughts about this. Why? Because I'm Dr. Pam Peek. I'm host of the HER podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek, Twitter, Pam Peek MD, or Instagram at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every single episode of the HER podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today, and please stay safe and stay well.